From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Atlanta Jewish Times has a history as varied and complicated as the community it covers. In 1925, the Southern Israelite was founded as a family-owned paper. It became the Atlanta Jewish Times in the 1980s when it was bought by a Jewish newspaper in Baltimore. A series of buyouts and editorial handoffs later, Michael Jacobs became editor, a position he's held twice in the past 13 years. He recently left the paper and joins me now in the studio to talk about it and the community that it covers. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Virginia.
So glad to have you here. Now, we do want to talk about Georgia's Jewish history, but first, a little bit about your story. You were born in New Orleans, right?
Yes.
And you grew up in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
Your very first newspaper job was as a sports reporter in high school?
Yes, at the local weekly newspaper.
Yep. Was that your ambition to cover sports?
No, it was just something I knew about, and that's where the job was, so there it was.
And then eventually you went to Tulane, worked on the paper there, but began your post-college newspaper career in Paterson, New Jersey.
Right. The North Jersey Herald and News in Passaic County, and started up there as a copy editor and was there for about 15 months. And the best part of the time I was up there, I was covering Paterson, which, fascinating place. It was celebrating its bicentennial since being founded by Alexander Hamilton, and it was really an interesting place to be.
So did you cover crime there?
I started out covering crime, and then I was covering everything that happened in Paterson. So it was city politics and culture and everything going on.
So that was when local papers were local papers. Are there many of those left anymore in places like Paterson, New Jersey?
Well, even then, there were fewer than there used to be. So even the Paterson paper at that time was a merger of previous papers. So there used to be the Paterson Evening News that was the big paper in that city. And it merged with other local papers to form the North Jersey Herald and News. And now that's been bought out by the local paper in Bergen County, and everything's been consolidating. I mean, it's been a process that's been going on for half a century. Really.
And this was in the 90s at that point,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Right.
Before the internet came and destroyed the newspaper industry, as
well,
people seem to think.
Right, that's the commonly held line, but you have another view.
Well, I mean, if you look at newspaper history, really, since World War II, circulations are going down as TV took viewership away, and just the industry changed. So there were lots of joint operating agreements where formerly competing newspapers would operate together on their business side, and then mergers, and eventually they just formed single newspapers. So you get things like the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, where all these papers used to be separate things and they came together because circulations were coming down. People just weren't reading newspapers as much, and that had nothing to do with the internet. That had to do with newspapers not doing a good job of connecting with their audiences anymore.
And this was exactly when you started the newspaper
business. Yeah, it was really good timing on my part. Yeah, I went to college thinking I was going to be a lawyer and try and be a sports agent because that was a lot of fun and looked lucrative. And then I got to college and decided, you know, there are probably enough lawyers in the world. Had a lot of fun working on the student paper at Tulane, where we really went after the administration. We wrote editorials calling this university president a thief and things like that. So that was fun. And I, you know, so I got attracted to newspapers. My father had been in journalism. And as friends of mine said, he really failed his job as a father because he didn't bring me around and show me how awful it was and how much I would hate it. So, which I don't, but I mean, he should have scared me off from that, and he didn't. So,
but I think a lot of reporters of your era began as beat reporters, covering crime, covering courts, you know, covering those kind of things that there are often in many towns no longer beats for. What goes missing when we don't have that?
Well, I think more than the crime that doesn't get covered, because that tends to be sensational and people will
forgive
jump in and
cover me.
That.
Crime is generally covered.
The really nitty gritty of what goes on in city governments and town governments goes missing. I mean, because nobody's there to sit through those long, grueling meetings that aren't on the surface very interesting, but really produce all the stories that are important to the town, because those are where the decisions get made. And if nobody's covering those governments and really watching what's going on, anything can happen. And it's not that the people in those governments are bad people, but they have their own interests. And as they say, you know, power corrupts. And there's nobody keeping an eye on them in most of these towns.
You know, the film Spotlight, which was about the Spotlight Boston Globe team. Well, I went to see them talking about this, and one of them said that we would not have known about this story had we not read that our Suffolk County reporter noticed that these cases were coming through over and over again. And the thing is that that Suffolk County reporting beat is no longer there.
Right. And municipal courts and local superior courts and things like that. I mean, nobody's covering those things.
How about the idea of, that the idea of objectivity suddenly became an important part or a more primary part of reporting in the 1990s? Is that so? I mean, this idea that you had to be objective.
I mean, I think that goes back to probably the 50s or the 60s. I mean, it's really sort of a phenomenon of post-World War II newspapers in the United States, I think. I mean, if you go to other countries and look at their newspapers, and if you look at newspapers that are from the 20s, the 30s, and going back before then, there were always parties that papers were aligned with political parties. They had certain positions, and they would promote those in what they were doing. And people would read either the papers that aligned with their interests, or they could read different papers and get a variety of interests. And for perfectly good reasons, newspapers became committed to the idea that we need to be objective and just tell the story the way it is. But what happens sometimes if you're too committed to saying making sure we get both sides of the story and not worrying about the truth behind those stories, you lose the passion that really motivates those stories. And people feel that. They get disconnected from the communities and the newspapers. And rather than being transparent in what you're trying to do and acknowledging that true objectivity is impossible, you get this sort of fake effort to be really objective and taking a step back. And when you take a step back from the story, you're taking a step back from the community and the people who care about it.
We're speaking with Michael Jacobs. He is my guest this morning and throughout the hour. And we're going to be talking a lot about his career in newspapers, what has happened to newspapers as a longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times, and also the community that he's been covering. Well, you were an editor, a writer in Patterson, but decided you wanted to be an editor, right?
Well, I'd always been more interested in the editing side than the writing side. So I was an editor in college, and I wanted to be a copy editor when I came out of college and started out being a copy editor, and they needed reporters. So certainly the reporters are the most important part of any newspaper because they're the people who are out there getting the stories, and they're the people out on the street, and they're connecting with people. But it's really important to have good editors behind them to help guide them along the way and polish what they do. And while I really enjoy talking to people and hearing their stories, I get a lot more pleasure out of helping polish other people's work than writing myself. So I think I'm pretty good at writing, but it's really not something that thrills me or excites me.
And you became an editor at the Washington Times. Now for listeners who don't know about that paper, tell us a little bit about its history and its land.
So the Washington Times was founded in 1982. It was actually founded by the Unification Church.
So Reverend Sun Young Moon's church.
Right. So it was criticized as being the Mooney newspaper, but it was established openly to be a conservative balance to the Washington Post, which is interesting because most of the people on the copy desk with me, we weren't conservative particularly. I mean, we were just there to do a job and to make sure that the paper was as accurate as it could be. But there were a lot of people on the national desk in particular who were there because of their conservative politics, and that was what motivated them. And I was there during the Clinton administration for the most part, and it was a really valuable time to be at the Washington Times.
Just
because,
like the opposition newspaper,
right.
I guess.
And I think that's an important role for there to be in the news industry, to have people who are specifically saying, we're going to try and find out anything that this administration is doing. We're not going to take them at their word. And that's what the Washington Times was doing for the 5 years I was there. So it was really interesting reporting. Some of it went over the line, but a lot of it was good stuff.
And over the line, did you ever have to pull back a writer from a story?
Oh, all the time. I mean, you know, reporters are motivated by whatever motivates them. So a lot of people were there and they just wanted to get Clinton, say. So, you know, we were involved in a lot of coverage of sort of scandals, like the Travelgate scandal involving the travel office and the there was Whitewater that we were doing. And there was also things like one reporter wrote the story about how he'd uncovered that Bill Clinton was a liar about what his name was, because Bill Clinton's father was, you know, not Clinton. His mother had had him, and then his father died in a car accident, and she remarried. And this reporter found birth certificate records and found out that, you know, thought he found out that he was really whatever it was, the fourth and not the third. And ha ha, he was lying about it. And it was the sort of like, A, you weren't right, but B, even if you were, so what? Yeah. And that's a question that I think doesn't get asked enough in any news organization. I mean, a lot of times you just need to step back and say, so what? Is there a reason we should care about this?
So what did that time at the Washington Times, how did that affect that view that you have about objectivity in the newspaper business?
I think the Washington Times built an audience such as it was because it was coming at the news with a particular attitude. It wasn't making stuff up. It wasn't trying to spin everything, but it was saying, you know, the stories that we want to cover are the ones that present this particular view on things. So it's not unfactual or untrue. It's just these are the, you know, we're not hiding what the perspective is.
So you went from there, Washington Times, to USA Today, where one of your duties was writing headlines. Is there an art to writing a headline?
Oh, absolutely. So I was on the life copy desk. So we were writing entertainment and music.
Do you have an example of a headline from?
So the one that I got an internal prize for was, you know, our Super Bowl on the life copy desk was the Oscars. So this was the year that Ashley Judd had done a whole lot of stuff, and the movie The Full Monty came out. And Ashley Judd, there was a excitement or buzz about whether Ashley Judd had been wearing underwear when she came
walking across.
Right. Well, you know, it gets back to a lot of the so what issue, but that was sort of the life copy desk. So she walked across the stage in this very high slit dress, and there was controversy about whether she was wearing underwear, and she came out the next day and said, no, I absolutely was wearing underwear. This is ridiculous. It was just the way the photos were. So the headline on that became Not the Full Ashley, playing off the Full Monty and all that. So it was fun.
But did you ever think it was just, I don't know, kind of silly?
Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, I mean, we did stories in the life section on health and wellness and science and things like that that were more important. But ultimately, none of it has that big an impact on people. People care about it and it's fun to do, but it's not, you know, it's not something that I wanted to spend my whole life doing, which is why after about 3 years there, I moved to rural North Carolina and became news editor of a small daily in Henderson, North Carolina. And when I told my boss that I was leaving, he said, well, is there anything we can do? Do we need to increase your salary? Do we need to match the salary? And I said, well, to do that, you'd have to cut my salary in 2/3 because that's what I'm getting down here.
Well, we will hear about reporting in Henderson, North Carolina, in just a moment. I'm speaking with Michael Jacobs, longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. His career trajectory follows in many ways the decline of local news coverage, which has been one of his goals. Left a job at USA Today to dig into regional issues. And we're going to find out where and how he did this and what happened when a national tragedy became personal. Please stay with us. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. European Jews were among the first settlers in Georgia. Now Atlanta ranks among the top 20 cities globally for a Jewish population. And the paper that became the Atlanta Jewish Times started covering this varied community almost 100 years ago. My guest today is Michael Jacobs. He's a longtime editor of the Times, for many years the paper of record among the state's plentiful Jewish population. Now, Michael, before the break, you left USA Today for a regional newspaper in Henderson, North Carolina, called the Daily Dispatch. Now, what were you hoping to accomplish there?
I really wanted to get back to doing community journalism and really stories that mattered to people in their everyday lives. So, you know, things at the life section of USA Today are fun and entertaining, but they don't really matter in what you're doing day to day. So get back to local news and the paper that really connects with people.
So the Oscars no longer the most important story of the year.
No, I'm not even sure we covered the Oscars in the paper.
Well, was it in Henderson when you became acutely aware of your family being among the only Jewish people in town?
Yeah, it was tough. We were about an hour north of Raleigh in Henderson. So we were an hour from a synagogue. The only other Jews really in the area around us were kids who were doing Teach for America and maybe one doctor's family. So there was not a Jewish community in any way. So the people there just weren't used to having Jews around. I mean, there wasn't overt anti-Semitism that I'm aware of, but they would do things like the public school would have an annual Easter egg hunt. And we said, you know, you really can't do that. And they said, you know, you're right. We're sorry. We'll just make it a spring egg hunt. Not quite getting the point.
And there was a quote unquote Jew store. Have I got that right? Something commonly known as the Jew store.
Yeah. So Henderson, as far as I know, never had a Jew store, which is what were commonly the common term in the South for the local sort of dry goods stores that Jewish merchants opened all over the South. But we covered a 3-county area, Granville County, Vance County, and Warren County. And Granville County's big city, Oxford, did have a Jew store going back. It was gone by the time we were there, but they had a history of that.
So they still called it that?
I don't know that any of the non-Jews called it the Jew store. I mean, that's as much a term within the Jewish community, I think, as outside the Jewish community.
So would it being so alone in your identity as a Jewish family do to your practice or your home life?
You know, we were very committed, and as we still are, to having a Jewish home. We would drive down to Raleigh at least once a week for Hebrew school and things like that. The synagogue was actually very nice. They, instead of having the normal, you know, requiring my children to be there 3 times a week for Hebrew school, they only made it have to be there twice a week because they knew how far we were coming. And we would try and go down for Saturday services as often as we can. But you really, you know, you have to sort of confront who you are. I think it made a big difference for my children in particular. They had a sense of difference that they might not have had if we'd still been growing up in Northern Virginia. And eventually, you know, we got to the point where they were getting old enough that we really felt like we had to get to a bigger Jewish community, which is part of what brought us to Atlanta.
And you did get that call to come to Atlanta to be the editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. Was it ever your goal to cover a Jewish community and Jewish issues?
It really hadn't been. It hadn't been something I thought about. I mean, I think partly I grew up, you know, with a strong Jewish community identity and, you know, going to synagogue and going to Hebrew school and all that. But it never was something that struck me as there being a need that, you know, to personally to be involved with the Jewish community in a way where I was working in it like that. We had the Washington Jewish Week in our home when I was growing up, and I would look at it, but it never really occurred to me as something that I would want to be involved with. But I guess being sort of isolated a little bit in North Carolina made me value the Jewish community a lot more. And so the opportunity to work in the Jewish community doing what I do in newspapers really appealed to me. So when the opportunity came, I jumped on it.
And I understand that on your very first day, what happened?
That Katrina hit New Orleans right when I started at the Jewish Times the first day.
And you grew up in New Orleans.
Well, I was born in New Orleans. I didn't grow up there, but I still have family there, including my grandmother was there, my uncle, cousins, and all that. So it was pretty stressful. I was here by myself. My wife and kids hadn't moved down yet. I was in an apartment. I had no idea what was going on in New Orleans. We lost touch with my grandmother for about 5 days. Didn't know what had happened to her. It was very scary and very stressful all the time while trying to start a new job. And you know, there was certainly a story that we had to cover here in Atlanta about Katrina, because there are a lot of strong ties between the Atlanta Jewish community and the New Orleans Jewish community going back for generations. So trying to juggle the professional responsibilities while, you know, worried about what was going on with my family was
tough.
And
your grandmother was okay?
As it turns out, she was. Her apartment building, which is right by City Park, was flooded on the first floor. She was on the third floor, which is fine. They were cut off for about 5 days. They were rescued by boat, taken to an airport, flown out by the National Guard to San Antonio, and then brought, you know, there she finally contacted my folks, and she spent about 4 or 5 months up in Northern Virginia with my parents and then moved back to New Orleans.
And she lived to be 104?
104. She died just recently, but she would have been 105 at the end of July.
She has a really interesting story, too. Tell us a little bit about your grandmother.
She is a native of Pattison, Mississippi, which is a suburb of Port Gibson, which is a Mississippi River town that General Grant decided not to burn because it was too pretty to burn. When she was a little girl, the family who, you know, again, the juice store sort of thing, they'd been merchants there. They moved to New Orleans, got to a bigger Jewish community too. And she was in New Orleans then for most of the rest of her life. She was the first in her family. You know, she went to Newcomb College at Tulane University, set it a family tradition. I was then my father went to Tulane, and my uncle and I went to Tulane, and my folks met at Tulane. So, you know, became a big family school. She started all that. She was a social worker. She was just a wonderful person, a lot of fun.
I understand that Atlanta and Georgia were a place that was, there were a lot of Jews, especially in the early days. Savannah, even when it was first founded, there were, tell me a little bit about the Jewish population back then.
So one of the early ships that came to Georgia, to Savannah, was packed with Sephardic Jews. And they didn't know, the colonial leaders, James Oglethorpe and people, didn't know that this ship was all Sephardic Jews until they got there. But they arrived, and there was an epidemic of some kind that was going on, and there were doctors on the ship, and they needed them, and so they allowed them to come ashore. And so during that first period around 1733, for a little while, one-third of the Georgia population was Jewish because of all the people from this one ship. It was 130 people or something, and a third of them were Jewish. So there was always a Jewish population here in Georgia going back to the beginning.
And continuing, Atlanta was a real draw for Jews in the South. Why was that?
I think for the same reasons that Atlanta was a draw for other people. It was a center of what was going to become the New South. It was a center of commerce. It was a rail depot. And it was where, if you wanted to do business in this part of the country, it was always the place to be. And so it drew Jews, and there have been Jewish families who have been business leaders and political leaders in the city going back 150 years.
And it was after the Civil War, I understand, during Reconstruction, that Jewish merchants and landlords would rent and sell to the newly freed slaves.
Yes. I think Jewish attitudes toward African Americans have always largely reflected the general population's attitudes, but there's always been an element of, you know, strangers in a strange land, and we are commanded 36 times in the Torah to be kind to strangers, and that matters to people, and so that's made a difference. That particularly at that period, there was a real question about, are Jews white anyway? So there was a common bond that was felt between these two minority groups that were outsiders to the general population, and they bonded.
And that's said to be one of the foundations of a lot of bonding during the civil rights movement as well.
It carried through, yeah. It's unfortunate that it seems to have broken apart some these days and since the 60s. But yeah, back in the civil rights era, the Temple, which was founded in 1867, was a bastion of support for Martin Luther King Jr., led by Rabbi Jacob Rothschild. And it was for that reason that the temple was bombed in 1958, because people didn't like that Rabbi Rothschild was very public in saying, this has got to end. Segregation has got to be over. We're all people. We need to be together. And, when Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize, it was Rabbi Rothschild who led the effort to have a huge community dinner for blacks and whites together to celebrate this important event for a native son of the city.
Had that ever happened before, anything like that?
No, it was unprecedented, and it was far and away the biggest integrated event that had been in the South up to that point.
I'm speaking with Michael Jacobs. He was the longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. And let's go back a little bit further from that, though. Many of the stories that I've read, or most of the history I've read, stress that Atlanta was not antagonistic towards Jewish people for the most part. But, of course, anti-Semitism didn't go away. Now, many people have heard of the Leo Frank case, but for those listeners who don't know, could you remind us?
Sure. In April 1913, on Confederate Memorial Day, a little 13-year-old girl named Mary Fagan was murdered in the National Pencil Factory in downtown Atlanta. Eventually, the authorities focused on Leo Frank, who was the manager of the factory, as being the suspect. They arrested him and convicted him that August in a trial that, depending on who you listen to, was either rife with anti-Semitism or was just sort of a railroading, because that was the guy that they focused on. The interesting thing about the trial itself is that the key testimony against Leo Frank came from a black night watchman. It's very rare up to that point that testimony from a black man would convict a white man. A lot of people say that the reason they were willing to believe this guy's testimony was because they didn't think that a black man could have been intelligent enough to make up this whole story, covering up his own role in the murder. There's lots of evidence that's exculpatory toward Leo Frank. It's 99% certain that he didn't do it. But he was convicted. He was sentenced to death in 1915. The governor commuted his sentence to life in prison. He was in the state prison camp in Milledgeville in August 1915. People from Marietta, who called themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan, kidnapped him from his jail cell. This was about a month after there had been an attempt to kill him in jail. So he was actually not in his cell. He was in the infirmary because he had almost had his throat slit. Well, he had his throat slit, almost killed. They kidnapped him, drove him all through the night back to Marietta and hanged him near where the Big Chicken is today.
Yeah, so he was lynched. Now, this is an incident that still haunts many Georgians, been revisited in books and plays, including Parade by Alfred Uhry and Jason Robert Brown. Here's a little clip from that.
Leo Frank is no longer a prisoner in the Fulton Tower. At 5 o'clock this morning, he was removed to another prison location, which will not be disclosed at this time.
Will you?
2,000 years ago, another governor washed his hands and turned a Jew over to a mob. Ever since then, that governor's name has been a curse.
So, Leo Frank's story dramatized in a play called Parade. How did that change relationships between the African-American and Jewish population, which had sort of forged somewhat of a bond in those years after the Civil War?
I think nationally there was a split. I'm not sure locally how it affected things, but there was definitely the effort to free Leo Frank and make the case that it was a case of anti-Semitism that had targeted him led to a lot of fairly nasty racial claims against the people who testified against him. So that's caused some lasting splits. The Nation of Islam, for one thing, continually puts out information saying Leo Frank did it and the Jews are horrible. Look what they did in this trial 100 years ago. But the bigger effect for the Jewish community was that basically it went underground for about until World War II. The Jewish community pulls back from being involved in civic life in Atlanta. You don't really see a whole lot of anything going on in Jewish life in the city after that point, because people were scared.
And the Atlanta Jewish Times during the Holocaust, what kind of coverage was it giving? You know, was it speaking just to the Jewish population at that point?
It was, but it's interesting that the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has done a project getting local newspaper coverage from around the country about what was being reported in the 1930s and 1940s. What did people really know about what was going on?
And they're
over
asking
there?
People just to submit stories from their old papers. Uh-huh. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. So the current owner, Michael Morris, put an effort into going through the Southern Israelite and finding the stories that had been there. Most of what was being reported was coming from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. There wasn't a lot of original reporting that was going on about Europe because this was a local paper. But there was constant reports about horrors going on in Europe. It was not a secret.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking with the longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. His name is Michael Jacobs. When we return, we're going to continue tracing a little bit of that paper's fraught history and find out what's in store for Michael's future and his reflections on the contemporary Jewish community. He's smirking right now. We'll see what his future is. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow on the program, Atlanta's rapidly growing population inspired the city to approve a $20.4 million land deal to expand Piedmont Park. It's part of a $100 million planned expansion. Who wins and who loses when that happens? And will this play out similarly around the state? As always, we would like to hear from you. Do you have easy access to green space? And if you do, how does it improve your life? If you don't, what are you missing? And what would you want? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Let's return to our conversation with Michael Jacobs. He recently left his post at the Atlanta Jewish Times after his second term as editor of the paper. Well, we talked a little bit about relationships between the African-American and Jewish community, and I know that there was a difficult spell. There was an editor, Andrew Adler was his name. Now, this is when the paper was going back and forth from ownership and Detroit and then local. Well, first of all, let's characterize that a little bit. How is that problematic if you have a management organization outside of the state managing a regional paper? How did that trying for you?
So, and it's a problem for newspapers of all kinds as they consolidated and created bigger chains, you get out-of-town ownership, out-of-town leadership, and they really don't understand the communities that their newspapers are supposed to connect with. It's hard enough for newspapers that are locally managed and owned to really connect with people properly these days with so many different options for where people can get information. When you're dealing with people who are in a completely different community, they just can't connect. So the Atlanta Jewish Times in the mid-80s was bought by a Baltimore family that owned the Baltimore Jewish Times. That was when the name changed from Southern Israelite to the Atlanta Jewish Times, giving that Jewish Times branding. They were also owned the Detroit Jewish News eventually. Then the owner of that family, the leader of that family died. The company split. So the Atlanta Jewish Times ended up being owned by people who ran the Detroit Jewish News. So they're up in Detroit. Detroit and Atlanta are very different communities overall. Their Jewish communities are similarly very different. Atlanta has been a rapidly growing Jewish community for more than 40 years. It's now somewhere around 130,000, 135,000 people. Detroit has been shrinking the Jewish community because people who could leave Detroit would leave Detroit. And in a bigger problem for the Jewish newspapers, the Detroit Jewish News, because there aren't a lot of new Jews coming to town, the people who read the paper have been reading it for generations.
Right.
In Atlanta, the people who are reading the paper haven't been here for a long time. I mean, you need to reach new readers. When the Jewish Federation of Greater Atlanta did a community survey in 2006, they found that 80% of the Jewish community wasn't born here. So that's a lot of people you've got to reach who don't have a habit of reading your particular newspaper.
So one of the attempts was what, a sort of lifestyle magazine newspaper?
Yeah. So the Atlanta Jewish Times had for various incarnations of a monthly lifestyle magazine. And they decided we need to relaunch it. The Detroit people, excuse me. So we got rid of the old glossy magazine and they said, okay, we have to have a glossy magazine. That's what advertisers want, is something glossy. We had a glossy cover on the newspaper at that point. We went up to Detroit, had meetings. How are we going to come up with a new magazine that's going to connect with people? We came out of those meetings and they decided we were going to do a magazine that wasn't glossy at all. It was just on bright white paper is what they call it. We got rid of the glossy cover on the newspaper. So the fundamental principle, we need glossy to appeal to advertisers, we wound up with no glossy. So now we've got a new magazine. We're going to launch it. We're planning to do all sorts of stuff. And Detroit decided they were going to come up with a name. And so they just went through a list of words that they thought resonated with Southerners. And so they decided the name of the magazine would be Julep.
It's spelled
like the J-U-L-E-P, but it certainly sounds like Julep, which isn't really clever branding. We fought with them and said, please let us call it something else. You know, it had been called High for Life before that. We suggested New, which means so in Yiddish and sort of brings people in, but nope, they wanted Julep. So they then said, we've got to have at least, I think it was 20,000 readers in the magazine every month to make it sustainable. So the way they did that is they just bought a bunch of lists of names in areas around Atlanta that sounded Jewish. So they created this mailing list that never got up to 20,000 people anyway, but they would send it out and we would get word back from people saying, I'm not Jewish, stop sending me your stupid magazine. I don't care about it. So it lasted about a year and a half before that went under. And it was sort of emblematic of the whole time of they were trying to find solutions that worked for them in Detroit to appeal to Atlanta. And it just didn't work. And they took increasing control. They continually cut back on our staff. They cut back on the size of the newspaper. They cut back on the control we had. And it was very frustrating, and it made it increasingly difficult to create a newspaper that worked.
Yeah, and sounds pretty tone deaf for the Atlanta Jewish population. But then they sold it to an Atlantan, Andrew Adler. Now, he wrote an infamous editorial. Please tell us a little bit about it and its aftermath.
Sure. So Andrew Adler bought the paper in, I think, April 2009. 2012, he didn't agree with President Barack Obama. So he wrote an editorial that basically said, you couldn't blame Israel's Mossad, their secret service, if they assassinated Barack Obama because he's so bad for Israel. Ooh. So the people didn't care for that too much. It created a national controversy. If you still to this day, if you search for Atlanta Jewish Times on YouTube, before you get to the Atlanta Jewish Times channel itself, you'll get a whole bunch of videos about this 2012 controversy involving Andrew Adler. So advertisers pulled out, people canceled their subscriptions. Andrew decided that he could not continue as the publisher and owner of the newspaper. So he sold it to a lawyer from Cobb County named Cliff Weiss, who didn't have any background in newspapers, but was committed to trying to keep this going. And he was able to keep it going for a little more than 2 years, and then Michael Morris bought it.
Well, we found a similar clip about Andrew Adler's infamous editorial.
The Atlanta Jewish Times dates back to the 1920s. Andrew Adler bought it in 2009, and he is now apologizing for writing in a weekly column that an option for Israel in dealing with Iran would be to, quote, take out the president of the United States.
And let's hear Andrew Adler's apology.
I'm going to start off by saying I am sorry. I apologize to everybody out there who I've hurt in no way or my intention to do that.
Now, you said earlier, Michael, that there was an ebb in the relationship between African Americans and the Jewish community in Atlanta. And of course, we're speaking in aggregates here. In the 1960s, after the Civil Rights Movement, what was going on then that may have even led to this kind of a foe?
Well, I think really 1967 with the Six-Day War is sort of a turning point in African-American and Jewish-American relations. I think, to understandably, a lot of Black Americans relate to the plight of the Palestinians who are disowned from land that they have for generations lived on. And so it's very easy to look at Israelis as being the sort of, you know, this superior population that's oppressing people. And if you feel like you're in oppressed class, you associate with other people who feel oppressed. And I think that's led to an increasing rift between the communities.
Well, and Martin Luther King, of course, he appealed to many Jewish audiences, likening the experience of the African Americans to the enslaved Jews in the Old Testament. Where is that relationship at now, do you think?
It's not good. There's this intersectionality movement among progressives that again sort of tries to connect all people who are oppressed in some way, and say we all have got to work together to try and, you know, lift everyone up. And the pro-Palestinian people who are also anti-Israel, and you don't have to be anti-Israel to be pro-Palestinian, but the people who specifically are anti-Israel and call themselves pro-Palestinian have made a real strong effort to try and associate the Black Lives Matter and groups like that with the plight of the Palestinians. Have the movement for Black Lives, when they came out with a manifesto a couple years ago, they included support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. And it creates a real rift because most Jews are politically liberal and support most of these causes that people who have been their political allies are now coming back and attacking Israel all the time. And it's really a tough position for a lot of Jews to be in, that they are both pro-Israel and support a two-state solution. They want to see the Palestinians come up with their own homeland and have their own state. But they also understand that Israel is in really tough situation, that they're under attack by their neighbors, that they have the Palestinian leadership does not accept that there is an Israel as a Jewish state. And that's so they are opposed to a lot of the, you know, things that are going on, while at the same time, the people they want to be allies with in the United States are lining up with these anti-Israel people.
Yeah, it's such a complicated situation that is often presented in a very simplistic term. So thank you for going through that. Michael Jacobs is with us. He is the longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. We're getting a view of, well, the long view, historical view of Jews in Georgia, and also a lot of contemporary figures, like one of the primary founders, or let's say figures in the Jewish community in Atlanta now. Tell us about the founders of Home Depot. This is a very important business here.
Well, so Bernie Marcus and Arthur Blank founded Home Depot, and fortunately decided that they would bring the headquarters to Atlanta. And they have since, through the many billions of dollars they made with that company, have transformed Atlanta, both the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. I mean, both of them are Jewish. Neither of them is from here, but both of them have made their lives here. And so Arthur Blank obviously owns the Falcons, owns Atlanta United, has been a huge philanthropist in the city. And Bernie Marcus has been at least as big a philanthropist. He's given a lot of Jewish causes. He's given to a lot of hospitals. He's supported Grady Memorial Hospital and Piedmont Hospital. And they've really, you'll see the Marcus Autism Center and the Marcus Stroke Center and, you know, all these things around town that are because of what Home Depot became.
Let's hear just a little bit of a clip about the concept originally.
I thought about this Home Depot concept for about 3 years, and Ken Langone, who was a dear friend of mine, said to me, "Why don't you open that store you discuss with me?" And so began the beginning of Home Depot.
And I think, you know, a natural question a lot of people have as a joke is, you know, what are Jews doing in the hardware business, right? So, and I think it's Mike Levin, who's another Jewish philanthropist in town and is the CEO right now of the Georgia Aquarium, which Bernie Marcus gave to the city. He tells the story that he had a conversation with Bernie about why he was in the hardware business, and Bernie said, you know, you have to come to a hardware store sometime. What if you need a screwdriver? And Mike said, if I need a screwdriver, I get out the vodka, I get out the orange juice, and I make a drink.
Another pair of brothers, a huge influence on history altogether, if not just Jewish history in the Atlanta area, that a lot of people may not know about, the Goldstein brothers.
Yeah. So they are dentists, I believe. And among other things, they were investors in real estate. So they founded the Americana Motor Hotel, which was the first high-class integrated hotel in Atlanta. And the important part about that hotel, aside from the value of having an integrated hotel in the 1960s in Atlanta, was that in order for the Milwaukee Braves to be allowed to move to Atlanta, there had to be a hotel where all the players from other teams could stay, and they didn't have to have whites in one hotel and blacks in another. So it was only once that hotel opened that the way was cleared for Milwaukee Braves to move down here in 1966.
Yeah, story not a lot of people know. What do you think, Michael, is the greatest misperception about Atlanta's Jewish community from outside of the community?
I mean, I think people outside the community naturally assume that the Jewish community is this monolith, that Jews all think the same way, support the same political parties, all do the same thing. And like any community, it's incredibly diverse. I mean, this community comes from all over the country. As I said, 12 years ago, 80% of the Jews who were here weren't from here originally. Diverse political views, diverse religious views, and we're split geographically all over the metro and Atlanta area. And I think people who get to know the community really can appreciate our diversity.
So what does that new younger demographic mean, do you think, for the future of the community as a whole?
Well, the Jewish Federation spent the last year with an initiative called the Front Porch, where they've tried to connect to what Jewish Atlanta is now and really unlock the potential. People don't realize that Jewish Atlanta is one of the most innovative Jewish communities in the country. I mean, we have lots of organizations like J-Screen and Sojourn and Jewish kids groups that have been recognized nationally as leading Jewish innovators. And the Federation realizes that it can't just be for people who don't know, the Jewish Federation is sort of like the United Way for the Jewish community. They collect money from the community and distribute it out to Jewish groups. The Federation realizes they have to be more than that. They have to be a place that creates locations for Jews of all kinds, whether, whatever their religious beliefs, whatever their gender identification, sexual orientation, everything can all come together and be one community. So they're creating spaces that are welcoming to all people. They're looking for new ways to unlock innovation. So they've got a new co-working space called Element ATL that's opening today. And it's very exciting what's going on and the future of this community.
Well, so now we're letting you off the hook for the future because we just don't have time to discuss your future, Michael.
Darn it.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Michael Jacobs, he's a longtime editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times. That's all the time we have for today on Second Thought. Is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for sticking around with us this morning, and please come back tomorrow at 9 o'clock.